Thank you, Sunday. Good afternoon, honourable members.
Thank you very much. I think it's important for us to start. Are you relaxed?
I'm trying, Sister.
Well, this is why you provided water so that it can cool you down.
Thank you.
Well, in 5 minutes, can you tell us who you are, your value system, as well as the experience and skills that you have, which you bring to the Office of the Chartered Accountants?
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Kholeka Gcaleka. I am 38 years old. I was born in Johannesburg. However, my umbilical cord is in a village called Umzimkulu in the southern KwaZulu-Natal. I grew up in Johannesburg. I grew up in KwaZulu-Natal in a rural area. My value system is mostly brought together by my upbringing. I was raised in a white family where my mother was a domestic worker. Therefore, for me, my identity is of pivotal importance because each time I went home with my parents, I always had a problem of not being able to speak my own language. So in my life, my identity is my grounding. Going back and growing up in the rural areas, having to experience the impoverished families in those areas, the lack of service delivery, the lack of water and sanitation, which is basic services, has grounded me deeply in humanity, understanding the struggles of people who are not close to services. Growing up in a Christian family, highly I am embroidered in Christianity. My values are aligned to the values in the Constitution of accountability. At home, we always had to account for every action that we take. I went to school at Westbury Primary School. I understand the impoverishment of communities in that particular area. I went to high school at Little Flower School, which was a Christian school. Accountability was the virtue. I also understand constitutionalism growing up in a democratic society, and that is one of the values that are core to me. Furthermore, equity is very important to me. Growing up as a young black woman in a society with the past that we are coming from, with all the struggles that it embodies. The experience that I'll be bringing, I have 15 years of work experience. Over 12 years in the National Prosecuting Authority. Of those 12 years, 6 years as a senior manager, senior deputy director of public prosecution. The 1 year I was acting, the other years I was permanent in the position. Thereafter, I served as a special advisor to the executive authority. For 11 months, I was on a break pursuing my studies. I am working again as a special advisor to another executive authority. Working in the South Gauteng division, which is one of the busiest divisions in the country, I have had to work with a lot of high-profile and complex cases. Highly embroiled in investigations, data investigations. Out of the high-profile matters that I've worked with, that I can recall, there's only one matter where I had an acquittal. I am also a strong leader and manager. Having grown up in the ranks of the National Prosecuting Authority, dealing with people of all sorts of life, you have to develop a certain resilience and grit, which I have developed, especially in working with the high-profile cases that I have worked with. I have assisted police with their investigations from inquiry stages. I have worked on matters of mismanagement by the police officers. I have trained police officers in investigations. I have trained doctors in how to complete J88 forms in order for us as a prosecution then to be able to acquire convictions, because the biggest problem was on how doctors would complete JHA forms, the investigations of the police. So I understand the due diligence, thorough investigations, ensuring that there's fairness in a particular trial. For me, that is the experience that I'll be bringing, but also stakeholder management. I chaired several stakeholder forums within the province. I participated in stakeholder forums nationally. I have international exposure. I have facilitated an anti-corruption workshop organized by the African Prosecutors Association in 2016. I have strong relations with the public service, the criminal justice system, the governance sector, which I'm currently working in. I believe that I bring a wealth of litigation experience. I bring a wealth of experience where I'm able to assess a case that is going to court, whether it's going to court in first instance or on appeal. What are the prospective outcomes? What are the risks? Which way to go? How to circumvent the particular risks in investigation? I have guided police officers in investigations. I have prosecuted in the High Court, Chairperson, since 2006 October until I left the NPA in October 2016. So I have almost 10 years experience of prosecution in the High Court and 2 years experience of prosecution in the lower court. I have dealt with specialized matters, especially matters of gender-based violence. I've dealt with corruption matters at the lower court. I am also currently serving on a voluntary basis in the committee that was established by the MEC of Gauteng for COCTA on the state of affairs of municipalities in the Gauteng province. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think something that I forgot to mention, I know Advocate Galeta as an advisor to the executive authority when I was in the executive. That is all. Robert Galeta, can you please confirm your disclosure in the questionnaire? Is there anything else that you would want the committee to know?
There is nothing else, Chairperson, except that there were some issues that were raised when I was related. So I don't know when will I get an opportunity to clarify those particular issues, but other than that, I have nothing.
I think we might come up during the course of the interview. If they do not, we'll give you the opportunity to explain yourself.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. In 2016, the Constitutional Court, in the case of the Economic Freedom Fighters versus the Speaker of the National Assembly and others, and the Democratic Alliance versus the Speaker of the National Assembly and others, the court made a judgment which had a fundamental impact on the functioning and powers of the public protector. Can you please explain what that court decision impact on the functioning of the public protector?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there was clearly no clarity as the enforceability of the powers of the public protector. Hence, in that case, after the public protector had made her remedial actions, there were other actions. The response that the president had gave, how the National Assembly responded to the particular matter, how the Minister of Police responded in the particular matter. But what the Constitutional Court did in this particular matter was to reaffirm the powers of the public protector to be enforceable and binding, and that they cannot be reviewed by any other structure, that the public protector is only subject to the Constitution and to the law. This case, the judges also framed the powers of the public protector to be pivotal in facilitating good governance in our democratic dispensation. It enforced the role of the public protector in upholding constitutionalism.
Thank you very much. I will now open the space for honorable members to ask questions. Honorable Putin, honorable Newport Blackham, honorable Mola, honorable Horn, honorable
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Advocate. Advocate, I just want to go to the questionnaire that you've been given, and I want to concentrate on employers. I want a clarity on, I'm not going to start with the one of the NPA, because I can see that 2004 until 2016, you've been rising in that department, am I right?
Correct, Honourable
Member. Okay. Now, from there you joined Home Affairs, and for me the indication here you were 4 months in that. Am I correct?
That is correct, Honourable Member.
Then following that you joined the Department of Finance and you were 10 months there. Am I correct?
That is correct, Honourable Member.
And the last one you've been to the Home Affairs again, and then you've been there for 9 months. Am I correct?
That is correct, Honourable.
Thank you very much. With that, noting that you want to be in this office of the public protector, do you think that you can be there longer if this is the idea or maybe the perception that I'm having about any on that?
Thank you, Honourable Member. In October 2016, Honourable Member, I started on the 1st of November 2016. As a special director to the executive authority, Mr. Malusi Gigaba, who was the Minister of Home Affairs. He was then redeployed after the 4 months I was there to the Department of Finance. After that, I think it came to 11 months, he was then redeployed to Home Affairs again. And I left with him through all these departments. And after he was removed from cabinet, my contract with him ended, hence the fragmented periods in between the departments.
Thank you very much for the clarification. Now, what is your understanding of what it means to be an anti-corruption champion?
Thank you, Honourable Member. My understanding is that you need to be somebody who understands, one, the causes of corruption, and you need to understand the system within which it operates, and you need to be well embroidered in good governance. You need to be well embroidered in the rule of law. You need to be ethical. You need to have integrity. You need to be an individual who can take independent decisions. You need to be an individual who can act without any fear, favor, or prejudice on any other person. You need to be an impartial person. That is my understanding.
Thank you very much. What more can be done to promote an ethical culture in government? Noting all the challenges that we've been having, it can be remedial action or any other matter that we've been seeing in the country.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Firstly, our systems need to be well-grounded, but also the individuals who are operating those systems need to be individuals with capability and the capacity. And they need to have a good understanding of the environment in which they work in. For me, an ethical conduct, more than anything, it is consciousness. if we breed South Africans who are conscious that this is their land, whatever act that they do that is contrary to any precept, it doesn't only affect them as individuals, but it will affect generations to come. We can put rules, as much as rules as we have, as we have done in the past, but still there is corruption. But as well, on the part of government, there also needs to be more action on the part of lifestyle audits. We need to know the lifestyle, especially of public service, especially those who work within the supply chain department. But also, in my view, is that keeping one person in one position forever, especially positions of that sort, it really does not assist. But also, we need to have a risk-based system, continuously assessing our system, that they are able to pick up any malfeasance, and also continue assessing our employees.
Okay, thank you. I just want to check
that's
with you.
One.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the, I think you understand Section 182 on the public protector. And I'm sure you'll understand that for you to get things going for yourself, working with the public protector, you need to be assigned responsibilities by her, the current one. But now, if it happens that it doesn't actually come your way, I'm saying this, noting the challenges that are there now in the department with the current one, what will you do?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Firstly, building a good rapport and interpersonal relationship with the person who supervises you is very important. I will try by all means to have good relations with my supervisor. But if that does not yield any results, I will have a discussion with her. And because the position of a deputy public protector is a position of a public protector in its construct. And you report to her and she needs to assign duties to you. If that does not happen, I will raise the issue in EXCO. If that doesn't yield any results, I will try and exhaust any other internal mechanisms available. And if that doesn't yield any results, I will bring the issue before this committee. Because it is also not a new issue to this committee. In the annual report, this committee raised the issue with the public protector. So she is also conscious that the issue of assigning responsibilities or delegating to the deputy public protector, it is actually a matter of public knowledge, and it is a priority to this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Advocate.
Thank you very much, Honourable Voice Drakens.
Hi, I'm Womania Drakens, voicing for me as my sign language interpreter, Trudy. Can you explain to us your understanding of the role of the Chapter 9 institutions within the constitutional architecture?
Thank you, Honourable Member. The Constitution sets out the role of the Chapter 9 institutions. The Chapter 9 institutions are meant to serve as the guardians of the public against the government. They are meant to be the body that ensures that the obligations of the government that are enshrined in the Constitution are being carried out by the government. And not just being carried out, but they have been carried out with due diligence. And they have been carried out within a specific time frame, that there is no undue delay in providing services to the people. But they are also there as a mechanism where the people are not happy with the government. They are able to raise their complaints, and their complaints can be attended to. Particularly, this position that I have been nominated for, the role of the Office of the Public Protector, is to investigate any public affairs, government organ, or any administration within government that has done their work in a manner that is improper or may cause any impropriety or any prejudice to any other person, to report on their particular conduct and to take appropriate remedial action. Thank you. Looking at the mandate of the public protector, sometimes we see a duplication or overlapping of functions with other Chapter 9 institutions like the Public Service Commission or the SIU. Now, if you should be appointed as the Deputy Public Protector, how do you envisage to avoid duplication or overlapping?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Starting from my previous work as a Senior Deputy Director of Public Prosecution, when dealing with the anti-corruption agencies, it is very important to collaborate and to cooperate with each other. It is very important to have memorandums of understanding where it is necessary. But more importantly, it is important to share knowledge amongst each other so that you know who is dealing with which case and what is it that they are dealing with, so that you ensure that there is no duplication in the work. Building relations within the anti-corruption agencies, it is very important so that you can assist each other in dealing with the matters and working on the matters consistently.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mola.
Thank you very much, Chair. Advocate Kalega, you have been in the employ of TPSA, Home Affairs, and NPA. Have you ever been called in a disciplinary hearing, even if you were acquitted or the charges left deliberate or you were found not guilty? Have you ever faced such a situation in all the three departments?
No, I don't remember. I have never.
While as an employee of the Trade Department, have you ever been charged by any state security agency any malfeasance, corruption, and other related charges, even if you were later acquitted and or charges left to understand that they were struck out of the run?
No, I don't remember. I have never even received a verbal warning.
Thank you. As in the questionnaire sent by Parliament to candidates, but are there any circumstances, financial or otherwise, that may cast doubt on you? That was question 2.1. The another question was, do you have any relevant matters which concern your honesty and integrity? And in both you have responded no. In the series of information we have been receiving as the committee, there is some concern coming from the Corruption Watch. Do you know what Corruption Watch is?
Yes, I do, Honourable Member.
They have a concern on matters relating to comments you have made in the NPA at the time when I forgot the name of the person who was in charge then, in the restructuring of NPA as an institution. They are equally taking some issues relating to you when you are at the employ of both Home Affairs and DPS. If you have knowledge of such occurrences, do you mind expanding for the benefit of this committee and for the benefit of South Africans in general?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I will start with the first issue. I have also read about it in the media, about a statement I issued in 2010 when I was the chairperson of the Society of State Advocates. Now, Honourable Members, I want to paint a picture in this issue. It is very important that I do so. The NPA did not operate on its own or in silos. It is part of the country in which you live in. It is a part of public institutions. Therefore, matters that were of concern in the public sector in this country, in the private sector in this country, issues of transformation were of great concern in the NPA. prior to my appointment as the chairperson of the Society of State Advocates, I was appointed as the deputy chairperson of the Transformation Committee in the South Gauteng Division, which is the division in which I served at the time as a senior state advocate. The issues that advocates raised, firstly, were the issues of remuneration. Advocates did not earn the same salary. The salary varied according to racial lines. Advocates were not being allocated the same kind of cases. Complex and big matters were hardly allocated to black advocates. And the concern was that when it came time for performance bonuses, the people who received performance bonuses are the people who did the complex and big cases, who could account for their performance during the period. When it came to promotion, the people who could be promoted are people who were doing complex matters. And this didn't apply to the majority of black advocates. As a result, we had a meeting with the then acting national director, Advocate Tim Kotevintie, who came to our office to hear what the advocates were saying. In that meeting, he then decided that we form a transformation committee that I became a part of, that would make recommendations to management on how to go about on this issue. And part of the issues that advocates raised was that, for example, we've got the Special Commercial Crimes Unit, which according to the NPA Act, they prosecute on behalf of the Director of Public Prosecution. There must be consultations between the Director of Public Prosecution and the Special Director of Public Prosecution who's responsible for the Special Commercial Crimes Unit. Yet, there is no consonant between the two units within one institution. There is the Asset Forfeiture Unit. Advocates would do cases and would not be motivated to refer these cases to the Asset Forfeiture Unit when it came to the part of confiscation orders in terms of Section 18 of COCA. So even the ASU used to complain that they are not receiving sufficient referrals. So these silos actually did not only affect individuals, but they affected the efficiency of work within the National Prosecuting Authority, which in itself is an important corruption fighting institution as a whole. So you can't in an institution like that have units that do not talk to each other. So when Advocate Sinelani was appointed as the National Director of Public Prosecution, these issues were already in the pipeline. So after my election as the chairperson, I then issued a statement in support of an input that Advocate Sinelani had given the Society of State Advocates at our AGM, where he was giving us a synopsis of how he intends to transform the NPA. We supported that, we wanted that. So, as a result, today, there are dotted reporting lines between the SCCU and the Director of Public Prosecutions in division. Today, advocates in the SCCU appear in the High Court and do their own appeals and also do some of the High Court matters. Today, advocates in the DPP's office actually do their own Section 18 matters. And it's important that I raise this, Honourable Member. The issue of not having proper conjunction between the reporting and the NPA Act actually played itself in the inquiry of Advocate Breitenbach, where the NPA was severely embarrassed in that inquiry, where the Special Director did not consult the DPP when he took the decision. Also, in the matter of freedom under law, when they took Mr. Lawrence Mkhwebe to court, the court emphasized these reporting lines.
I'm inclined to propose the following so that we don't eat on the time. And at the same time, we think that this is a matter of serious importance because these were the matters that we raised and we thought that they need to be ventilated seriously in this committee. Now, can I propose that maybe we give her 5-10 minutes so that she covers everything? Will not be reflecting on it. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to get clarity. When covering everything, because there were other matters that were raised in the media that I read off, should I cover all those matters as well? Thank you, Chairperson. In finalizing this issue, honourable members, I at no stage, I am in possession of the statement, I can have it emailed to the committee, I at no stage that I support the closure of the two units. The support was for the transformation in principle, because the management of the NPA was still going to convene and decide how the structure must be formed. Secondly, I'm not aware of anything regarding the Department of Home Affairs and DPSA. I have just joined the DPSA, it's been a month. So at Home Affairs, I'm not aware of anything. I am, however, aware that I was assigned to the Agri-Realty matter and the PEFO matter. I honestly, honourable members, I cannot fathom how that can be an offence or be unethical. I didn't read of any act on my part that was said to be improper, you know, in that particular case. I was appointed, we were assigned as a second team onto the case. We were a team of three. I was a junior in the case. Yes, the accused was acquitted in the case, but lawyers use cases all the time. Unless there was any wrongdoing on our part that led to the acquittal or any corrupt act and so forth, which in my view I feel that it is a matter that 9 years later or that can still be reported to the authorities if there was any wrongdoing on my part. Honourable members, there's also the issue of Mr. Richard Mzungu's matter, quite a contentious matter. Chairperson. I was assigned this particular matter in 2010. It was still at investigation stage. I really did not know who the matter was about. I guided the police in investigation in the matter. After 3 months, I got to know who we're dealing with. I reported the issue to the acting director, giving feedback as I regularly did. And I also requested assistance of another advocate because the work was mounting. But also, it was very clear that it is going to be an extensively heavy matter. I was assigned Advocate Barnard to continue with the investigations. We were ready to arrest. In fact, not only on the assault, the attempted murder, and the murder charges, we also had the information on the corruption and the fraud charges. At that stage, we had not clearly established the jurisdiction. I signed the warrants of arrest. We briefed the National Director of Public Prosecution, who supported us. There were a lot of other things going mayhem in the case. However, we managed to have the accused arrested. He presented himself in court. We thereafter held the bail application. We have issues were raised of conspiracy, that was the defense. We continued with the case. At some point, charges were withdrawn. We were referred to the inquest court to do an inquest, which in our view we felt it was not necessary. We felt that we had sufficient evidence to proceed with prosecution. However, we took instructions. In the inquest court, for some reason, the magistrate overreached his powers and cleared Mr. Zulu in the case. We wanted to review the matter. We were not allowed to review the matter. Again, the issue of a conspiracy was continuing. At some point, they even said that the prosecutors were involved in the conspiracy. Now, we didn't want to jeopardize this case. It is a case that we had to ensure that justice takes place. It is a case where the family had waited for 12 years to see justice being done. I then approached the acting director of public prosecutions and I requested that we get another senior advocate who was not involved throughout the other proceedings in order to dispel the issue of the conspiracy. vice van Zyl SC was then assigned to the matter. At that stage, when vice van Zyl was assigned, we had not consulted with much witnesses, but what we did, Chairperson, was to record each and every consultation. There were contentious witnesses, there were previous police officers who had worked with Mr. Richard Mzuli, who were contradicting the documents, the work that they had done previously at the time of consultation. Now, we continued with the matter. Fortunately, Freedom Under Law took the MTA to court. The matter had to be reinstated. We then went for trial. The conspiracy defense continued. The matter went on for many years. In 2016, I received an offer to be an advisor. I resigned. I had been on that matter for 6 years. So it was close to the end of the state's case. Now, when I resigned, the defense then brought this witness, whom we had consulted with, but we had decided that we would not call him, who then said to court, I had coerced and bullied him to implicate Mr. Mzuli. The state, the defense then wanted the state to call me as a witness. Now, if you prosecuted, you would know what the trick is. The state handed in the recordings, the court found them to be authentic and admitted them as evidence in court. And the court ruled that there was no reason for me to be called as a witness. In fact, Mr. Mzuli has been convicted on some of those charges. The court has assessed that evidence, Chairperson, and has rejected that evidence as being false and has been a fabrication by that particular witness. The last one, Chairperson, that I can remember is the issue of me amongst other advisors of Mr. Gigaba whilst with National Treasury receiving the report of the Tegeta matter, which implicated the Gupta family on the coal mines. Now, Chairperson, the first time I learned of this matter was in a meeting where the chief procurement officer, Mr. Starr, was briefing the minister. In the meeting, there were officials from the ministry and officials from the department. After he had presented his briefing on the preliminary report in the matter, there was consensus in the meeting that, it, in fact, the matter justified forensic investigation and also to be referred to the House. I received the final report after it has been signed and recommended by the Director General, which the Minister approved, signed, and it was referred to SCOPA in Parliament. I, from the allegation, I can't hear any allegation of what impropriety did I do, what wrong conduct did I do, or any other conduct, except being said that I received the document for the Director General, which is false. But even if I had, what would I have done about it? The matter was referred. Forensic investigations happened. The matter was referred to the House, which was consensus. Chair, that is all that I'm aware of. If there's anything else, I am willing to respond to it.
Thank you very much, Advocate Taleda.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Advocate Kaleka, let's go back to the Economic Freedom Fighter DA cases against the Speaker of the National Assembly, but in a different context this time. Yes, we agree it has reaffirmed the enforceability of the Public Protector's remedial actions. But there is another triggered discussion in society now of when remedial actions are established against you by the public protector, you have a right to take them for a judicial review by the court of law. Now, that went back to a discussion on what then becomes the status of the enforceability of those remedial actions. Some argue that when the are taken to a judicial review to the court of law by the affected family, they cease to be enforceable until such time the court pronounces itself in the matter that the subjudicial rule applies. Some convict that whether you file for judicial review or not, they are still applicable and enforceable even at the time when the court has not yet pronounced on them. What is your view with regard to that?
Thank you, Honourable Member. My view on that issue is that they are enforceable until there's a pronouncement by the court. Many people, like Mr. Godin had done, was to do an interdict, to interdict the enforceability. For me, that is the way to go. If you do not want them to be enforced immediately because you are bringing in an application to review the findings or the remedial action of the public protector, without an interdict, they are enforceable.
The last one, Chair. Section 2 of the Public Protector Act says that the Deputy Public Protector acts in accordance to what has been delegated by the Public Protector. As things stand now, there's been a lot of losing of cases and legal costs being adjudicated against the office and the public protector in person. Let's say you are in a scenario where you are appointed as the deputy public protector and there are no delegation framework vivid yet given to you, and you say that there is something that is going wrong in the office. What do you do?
I remember I would obviously approach the public protector. I cannot assign functions to myself. Before, when you enter an office, before you perform any work, there's a performance contract that is signed between the supervisor and the employee. So it is from that performance contract that I would negotiate my duties, but also wait to be assigned matters. However, I would advise the public protector, you know, whether she takes my advice or not. I mean, with the experience that I have on how to approach such cases, it would be quite beneficial to her. I would still advise her whether she takes the advice or not. But also, as I've responded previously, if she doesn't take the advice, because, you know, looking at what is happening regarding, well, we've become a very litigious society, and the public protector's office is highly affected by that, so it's a very serious matter. And considering her budget constraints and all of that, serious interventions are regarded in that respect. If no advice is being taken, I will again come and approach this particular committee on the issue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mora. Honorable Horn. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. You, in your introductory remarks, said that there was only ever one acquittal in respect of cases you dealt with. And later on, you referred to the acquittal in the Abiyati matter. Is that the one acquittal?
I remember I said it was one acquittal in the high-profile cases that I had dealt with, and yes, I was referring to the Abiyati matter.
Thank you. Now, in respect of your work as special advisor to Minister Malusi Gigaba, am I correct in concluding that you were in fact a legal advisor? That was the nature of the advice you were given.
That is correct, Honourable Member.
Okay. So, during his tenure as the Minister of Home Affairs, it was the Fireblade Aviation matter, in which ultimately first the High Court and later confirmed on appeal found that he deliberately told certain untruths under oath. To what extent were you involved as his legal advisor in dealing with the finalization of those statements under oath?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Firstly, Honourable Members, I must place it on record that I joined the Department of Home Affairs as the special advisor, legal advisor to Mr. Malusi on the 1st of November 2016. The Fireblade matter had been going on for years preceding that. When I arrived, there was counsel on the matter. Documents were being concluded. I was never part of any meetings that had taken place prior to that. So on the factual basis of that case, I had no knowledge because I was not his advisor at the time.
Thank you. Turning to your questionnaire, in paragraph 5 in dealing with the second question, which turns on the challenges facing our country and what you could add or bring to the party if you are appointed as the Deputy Public Protector. In paragraph 5 there you make the interesting comment that it's very important for the Public Protector in ensuring that in its investigations it does not pander to interests or lobby groups. Now we all know the Act and the law says subject only to the Constitution and the law and must act without fear, favour or prejudice. What, given history and your perception regarding the Office of the Public Protector, led you to make that specific comment that there must be a careful watch not to fall to lobby groups and interests, other interests?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I remember the Public Protector's office has become a very big point of interest to a lot of interest and lobby groups. I mean, it is common cause that you would find different organizations, NPOs, wanting to say how the Public Protector must perform her functions, which decision is wrong, which decision is not. You find political parties also involving themselves on which decision is right, against who must be investigated. So it is against that background that I made the particular point that the Public Protector must be at all times be independent and work in accordance with the Act and the Constitution.
Yeah, there is also a view that what is seen specifically in more recent times is actually the factional battles of the governing party to which you in government has now served as a special advisor, playing it out in the matters referred to the Public Protector to deal with. So if you are appointed, how will you ensure that you also steer clear of settling factional scores?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I was an advisor to Mr. Kikaba for 2 years. I am now an advisor to Mr. Senzo Mchunu MP. I've advised two different persons who are members of the governing party. My advice to them is on the facts and on the law, not on the politics. I'm not a political advisor. I'm a professional. Honourable Members, I have worked in the professional sector under the NPA for many, many years. And what is important is to uphold the rule of law and constitutionalism and stay clear of any faction.
Very much, Honourable Horn, Honourable Dennis Breitenbach.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Honourable Members.
You have spoken at some length about independence and the need, therefore. Can you tell me why you regard independence as such an important quality in the Office of the Public Protector, and how would you guarantee this committee that you would be independent? I have other questions, but do that answer.
Thank you, Honourable Member. The fact that the Constitution had expressly stated independence of this office. It is clearly a very important factor because it serves the interests of the people of South Africa. So in exercising the powers given into this office, it is important that if they exercise independently without any external influence outside of the facts, the evidence before me, and what the law says. And the circumstances of the case taken into consideration, most importantly, the complainant, but also ensuring that there is fairness on the other side. How I would ensure that I exercise the independence is to stick to the rules of the law, is to ensure that the work that I do is transparent, there is openness, I am able to account for the work that I do, but also that I don't flutter procedures and processes, because at the level of a deputy public protector, I suppose as it is in the NPA, for example, if it is not a representation, at that senior level, we don't receive the matter at first instance. The matter would start with investigation. Whoever would oversee the person who's doing the investigations, receive recommendations and upwards, but I would really ensure that I look at the matter in line with the law.
Thank you. May I ask you to try and keep your answer a little bit more brief? We all have a time constraint. You've also mentioned rule of law quite often now. Could you tell me what is the rule of law? What is due process?
Thank you, Honourable Member. What I understand by the rule of law is the constraints that are provided by the prescribed laws or legislation to individuals and institutions on their powers and actions.
And due process?
What I understand by due process is ensuring that there is fair treatment on how you deal and process a particular matter. For example, in the Office of the Public Protector, ensuring that when you receive a complaint, you inform the other party, you provide them with the complaint. And where there are instances where the complainant must remain anonymous, you remove those particular details. But there is clarity on the other person on what the complaint is. Providing them with sufficient time, informing them of your provisional reports, informing them of your final reports in order to ensure that you properly hear what the other side's story is. And where there is no evidence, to be able to say that there is no evidence, but where there is evidence, so that you know that you followed due process and the decision that you have taken is covered.
Thank you. Then let's talk a little bit about your time at the National Prosecuting Authority. Mendes Simelane was a wrecking ball in the National Prosecuting Authority. He's the architect of dismantling the specialist units in the NPA, and he decimated their ability to oppose state capture. You supported him vociferously. You stated, as the head of the Society of State Advocates, that you supported the courageous transformation agenda of Simelane. Now I know you explained it, or explained why you did it. I need a little bit more. I don't buy your explanation. He was subsequently removed from office as unfit to hold that office by a court. Why did you support him? Why did you not fight as the head of the State Advocates Society for the independence of the prosecutors? Why didn't you fight for the rule of law?
Thank you, Honourable Member. In my knowledge, there was no instance where Advocate Simelane had suppressed any prosecutions. In fact, I gave an example of the Mzuli matter. He supported the team in the prosecution of the Mzuli matter. Now, I am speaking in accordance with my experience. The dismantling of the units I'm not aware of, it is a principle that he had made input to us about that we supported. But supporting the dismantling of institutions, I never supported. My statement is very clear, it doesn't state so. And the other point is, every person has got an idea, but the NPA is a strong institution that had a management of the institution at the time. Hence, if indeed you wanted to dismantle the institutions, it did not happen. The institutions were not dismantled. If he had the intention to do so. Clearly the NPA had the management to stop that particular act from happening. I supported a principal. There was no way that I would have taken office as a society of state advocates when state advocates had so many grievances and be at loggerheads with the National Director of Public Prosecutions when we required his support on the well-being of prosecutors.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Zelle.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Advocate Aleka.
Good afternoon, Honorable Leda.
Yes, I just want to know, as an individual, considering the period that you have worked with these different individuals, Advocate Simelani, Mr. Gigaba, Mr. Mzuli, and the situations or the shenanigans around the whole situation. I just want to find out. Do you think it is fair that you are judged based on all those things that they might, the society or the people might think that they have done wrong?
Firstly, I prosecuted Mzuli. I was really surprised when he was presented as a victim in the newspapers, when everybody else, the society at large, wanted him prosecuted and wanted justice to be done. I worked with Advocate Simelane. I was a senior deputy director of public prosecution in the South Gauteng region. I did not work in his office. I am one of the many prosecutors.
Just wanted to know that is it fair for how she's been just as an individual? Just give me, is it fair that you are just based on whatever that happened?
I believe that it's highly unfair.
Thank you. My other question is that maybe you can share with me with this committee what you have learned in the whole situation as a person.
Thank you, Honourable Member. What I've learned is that it is important to uphold values. It is important to act in line with the law. It is important to be an independent individual with your own views. It is important to stay professional if you are a professional. And it is important to ensure that justice is done where justice should be done.
With all the challenges that the Office of the Public Protector is experiencing, be it legally, be it perception, and all that she is facing and the office is facing right now, what value would you think that you'll be taking to that office if you employ you?
Thank you, Honorable Member. Firstly, I have strong litigation skills, as I have alluded to previously. I have that eye to be able to look at a matter, be able to assess what the gaps are. So the most important value that I will be bringing is that ensuring that there's thorough investigation. I also have mediation skills, ensuring that matters that do not require investigation, they are speedily finalized through other available mechanisms. But also, having worked with high loads of matters in the National Prosecuting Authority, case management, dealing with backlogs, but also ensuring that you build an environment where people work together as a team, building a capable team, enhancing the skills of the team. I'm trained to train. I have trained prosecutors, police, doctors. But also ensuring that the remedial actions are in line with the law, having practiced the law for so many years, and that they can stand the test of time.
In your assessment, in what areas you think that the public protector has successfully done their mandate?
Thank you, Honourable Member. I think on the administration side, on one of their programs, I mean, they've got quite a good audit outcome. But as well, you know, having the courage to take up matters of people from the highest of offices, and I'm not speaking about the public protector as an individual, but I'm speaking about the office. And I think what that office has done to the mandate of the public protector, it has uplifted it. It for us even today to have a judgment which says that the remedial actions of that office are binding and enforceable, that for me is the courage that came out of that particular office, and it has really done well for the country and for the people of this country.
What would you do to address a situation whereby the organ of the state ignores or refuses to implement the remedial action of the public protector?
Honourable Member, I would take the matter to court for an application for the remedial actions to be enforceable, so that if they still do not enforce, then they would have contravened an order of court. So I would apply for the remedial action to become an order of court.
Thank you very much. In my list, I think those are the honorable members who have asked questions.
Still noting. Oh, okay. I will be here.
Honorable Chanji, Honorable Josie, Honorable Isha Mohammed. Those are the three. So let us reduce. Honorable Isha Mohammed will be the last one.
Ms. Kalek, in your submission in the questionnaire, the special advisor role touches by now three departments: Home Affairs, Finance, then Home Affairs and DPSA. Yet the chair had indicated that where he was before, which was not in those three departments, you were once a special advisor. And I think that...
Can I correct it?
Oh, okay, correct it.
I say when I was in the executive,
oh, okay.
I knew her special advisor to one.
I get it. My Liba Mark of the Sisa Owen. Check. For clarifying that. What's your view? You've spoken a lot about it. The remedial action is binding. Is it absolute?
It is not absolute. It is binding at the time that it has been made. The fact that it is reviewable through the judicial system makes it not to be absolute.
Thank you. Have you done some research on this office that you want to be part of, the Public Protector's Office?
I have done so, Honourable Member.
Thank you. What's the budget of that office?
The budget of the office, Honourable Member, is 320 million rand. Out of the 320 million rand, 250 million rand is only for the compensation of employees.
Thank you, Corporal. How many programs do you have in that department?
What I've read in the annual plan is that there are three programs, mainly administration, investigations, and stakeholder management.
Pause there. What, in your view, having done that research, hopefully you've done, you've read the annual reports and the APPs, I hope. Can you give me just two major weaknesses that you have picked up that if successful here, that would be what your first task to as part of your support and advice? What are those two major weaknesses of that office? I'm not talking perceptions now, I'm talking based on the research you've done.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Based on the research that I've done, Honourable Member, I've realized that considering the financial constraints, there is insufficient coordination and collaboration with other corruption agencies. For example, ensuring that there is no duplication of matters. Also ensuring that if a matter has got a criminal impact, then the public protector, considering the constraints, can rather refer that matter to the HOTS for investigation, because in any event, the final remedial action on what happens to the matter does not lie with her. So that would be my first assessment on the matter. Secondly, it is the issue of the turnaround of senior management in the office. It is important to build a capacity and a skill, but also that can be retained in a particular office. So what I would also do is to find out what are the issues. The public protector, I think in the last time when she presented the annual report, she raised issues of low morale amongst the staff and so forth. So it is important to build that amongst the staff.
In the same annual report, we raised the ballooning exorbitant litigation costs. I don't know if you come across that. What would be your remedy on that? Firstly, what do you think that is the cause for that, and how would you assist to remedy that situation?
Honourable Member, the courts are the final arbiters on any matter, and up until the Constitutional Court, the courts have raised concerns with the quality of investigations. So that is, and the fact that the remedial action is easily reviewable. We've seen a number of cases, especially high profile cases, where the review has been successful. So it tells you that there is a gap in the investigation. So with my experience, that is where I would strengthen the Office of the Public Protector, but also to ensure that punitive measures are always the last measure you take and under, you know, really needed circumstances. So if a matter can be resolved in any other matter, in any other way rather, let us rather go for that particular way than to have a matter where we conclude through systematic investigation, having spent a lot of money to those investigations, and again going to pay another cost. I've seen others are ranging from nine million.
Okay. Pause there. Just want to share this as I wrap up, Chair. I just want to read you a sentence from the last judgment of the Constitutional Court on that office. And it reads section 207 says, the public protector's entire model of investigation was flawed. She was not honest about her engagement during the investigation. In addition, she failed to engage, and this is a point you made earlier on, with the parties directly affected by her news media action. This is damning, amongst other things that have been raised there. And the investigation is a major component. The public protector is not about investigation. Anything else in support. What do you think what value do you think you bring, given your own experience in the NPA, put aside the advisory, because I regard that as sabbatical, but let's get into this.
I remember having done a lot of appeals before judges in the High Court. I know what judges look for in their review letter. I've also done reviews before the High Court. So when you do your investigations, I receive the letter. I already have the eye and the mind of
what are the questions would the judges be raising should the matter be sent for review? And if we do not have those answers, and if we are not absolute on the law, and whether the evidence that we have reconciles with the law, we rather deal with the matter in any other form than to proceed on the remedial action that is going to go and review and it be set aside.
But my last point, Chair. Just share what is your understanding of judicial ethics and where a judicial officer fails to adhere to them, what should be the consequences of a judicial officer?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Judicial ethics is almost the same as the Office of the Public Protector or any other public office which is enshrined in the Constitution. Being ethical is doing your work in line with the facts that are before you, applying the law that is applicable, coming up with a judgment that is in line with the law and the facts, working independently, impartially, without any fear or favor. Now, if there is a challenge with judicial ethics, there is the Judicial Services Commission, where you are able to report when there are matters of any impropriety or any unethical conduct that would have been picked up. But also, the mechanism within the judiciary is that there is an appeal process, there is a review process up until the Constitutional Court. So whatever judgment would have been done by one judge, there is the next step for another judge or other judges, a full bench, to have a look into those particular matters.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ndlozi.
Thanks, Chairperson. I want to follow this line of questioning regarding ethics. So when you work in the department as a legal advisor, in essence, you're not working for those departments, you're working for the minister. Am I right?
That is correct.
That's why you move with him.
I'm the advisor to the minister.
Yeah, that's why you move with him. Am I right?
That is correct.
You're working for this guy on his personal discretion that they need your advice. Am I right?
Not on his personal discretion. Section 12, capital A of the Public Service Act sets out that a special advisor's duty is to advise the minister or the executive authority. So it's in his capacity as the executive authority on his powers and on his duties.
Yeah, it seems to me whether you get hired or not is his discretion. That's my point. Even if you are executing those things, that's why you are moving with him. You're working for him as an executive authority. That's my point.
As executive authority.
Yes. Now, why did you continue working for him after the court said he lied under oath?
I had no reason not to work for him.
So you are prepared to work at that level for a person that the court of law said they lied under oath? That's fine. There's no ethical conflict in you.
There is none, Honourable Member.
Excellent. So let's go back. Why did you leave the NPA to advise ministers? If you're so passionate about fighting for justice, it seems to me pursuing criminals at the NPA, finding justice, in particular this high-profile case that you're involved in, leaving it for a lucrative job, doesn't hold you like a person who's actually passionate about justice. What's your reaction to that?
Honourable Member, at the time, and I think if you could take notice of the report, the NPA was very volatile. There was many threats on my life. As a result, I had VIP protection. We were not seeing eye to eye with management on the issues of the Mjuli case. And as I've alluded to before, the matter was taken to court by the Freedom Under Law. That is why we ended up prosecuting the matter.
I don't understand.
And also, the reason why I left, at a young age,
I took up
a senior manager.
Just one second, don't worry. I'm interrupting you because I only have 5 minutes. I'm not being rude. You left because your life was under threat?
No.
What are you saying?
No.
Why did you leave the NPA to be an advisor to a minister? Your answer is, my life was under threat. Did I hear you properly?
It is a component of my answer, Honourable Member. May I kindly explain further, please?
Okay.
So, at a young age, I took up a very senior position in the NPA. I had served in that position for 5 years at the time. Like any other young person, I had other ambitions to grow. Now, in the environment in which I was, under the circumstances, I had no provision to grow further. And I had realized that. That is why I took up the other position.
So you left part of it that your life was under threat that made you leave. You're still young. Your life may be under threat in the NPA, in the public protector. That's even worse. That's the highest call. So how do I know you won't run away again?
Honourable Member, the threat on my life were in 2010, preceded up until 2014, I think. By the time I left, we no longer had VIP protection, so there was not even a threat at the time. Hence, I am saying that my answer cannot be broken down. It's a cumulative of issues.
So there are two things. Why did you tell me about life under threat if it doesn't matter? I don't understand. So let me concentrate on growing. Now, the trajectory seems to be you leaving this fight for justice in the NPA to be an advisor. There's no fight for justice there. So it's about career.
A fight for justice, Honourable Member, doesn't only mean that you need to stand in court. However, advising a minister on issues of governance, strategy, administration, for me, it is also a fight for social justice. A lot of the people of South Africa are not receiving services. The minister is in a position to take decisions. So if I can advise...
Then he started lying under oath, and you still work for him. The court says this man is a liar, and then you still work for him. I'm not sure about your ethical compass. This is a Chapter 9 institution. Shouldn't this highest call require a higher demonstration of ethics?
Honourable Member, my ethical conduct cannot be questioned on the decisions I have taken from being the lowest prosecutor.
No, I'm asking about the decision. Sorry, I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the decision to stay working for the person that the court said they lied under oath.
By the way, Honourable
Why is that question your decision to stay and work for the person who lied under oath?
By the way, Honourable Member, when the Constitutional Court pronounced itself on that decision, 14 days later, Minister Gigaba resigned. So there is no period that can be said that I then stayed and worked for that particular man.
Even for 14 days, not a period. Okay. Are you a member of the ANC? Have you ever been a member of the ANC?
I am currently not a member of any political party. I have been a member of the ANC. I grew up in the ranks of the ANC Youth League. I have led in the ANC Youth League. I have, however, not had membership of any political party, I think, for about 8 years now or so.
8 years?
I think I'm not accurate.
So why
but it's been a couple of years.
Why didn't you tell us about this important fact of your struggle credential?
Honourable Member, I am not going to carry out a function when my struggle credentials are required. However, my struggle credentials are known. There were nothing to hide.
Well, I didn't know.
I am responding.
I didn't know that. The last question is the last one, Chair. Please indulge me. Thank you. I appreciate it. I will remember this. The last question. You see, when a court decided, and it has to do again with the remedial action, the enforceability of remedial action, when that ruling of the Constitutional Court in relation to the EFF case, it seems to me we can read it as the remedial action of the public protector are binding until set aside by a court of law. Why do they still need a court to enforce them? I mean, it doesn't seem quite creative, because if a person ignores them, they've already been declared as binding until a review. Are there there other creative ways that these remedial action can be enforceable when ignored by powerful people who are even prepared to lie at a court? That's my final question.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member, the creative ways can be cooperation. For example, if it is a minister who has done that particular act, the minister is answerable to Parliament, then the public protector can then approach Parliament to ensure that their remedial actions are being adhered to. But also, what normally happens with members of the executive, members of Parliament, when the public protector passes the remedial action, it will also be referred to the Ethics Committee to accordingly deal with that particular matter. So that is the other angle of dealing with those matters, other than going to enforce it in the particular court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Tisha Mohammed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Edward Baleka. Just two short questions, moving my hands around, moving forward in the future. The term of the public protector, now, chair of the committee, you
okay, Mohammed, can you speak to the mic?
Oh, thank you. Just with regard to the term of the public protector, the office itself, do you share with the committee your strategic vision for this office?
Thank you, Honourable Member. My strategic vision, which of course will have to be aligned with the vision of the public protector, because mine is to be a deputy. Firstly, it is to work to uplift the integrity of the office of the public protector. And in so doing, it is to ensure that we increase the quality of investigations that go into the matters that the public protector is dealing with. For me, that is of paramount importance, because the integrity of the office, the dignity of the office, and the confidence which the public has in the office derives out of the quality of the matters that the office is dealing with. And we get the quality of the matters out of the judgments of the courts of those matters that actually go to review. That for me is the primary strategic vision. Secondly, is to ensure that there is a proper case flow management so that it can ensure not only just due diligence, but also there's a systematic way in which all parties involved in the chain of that case engage in those particular cases, but also the coordination and cooperation with other stakeholders is of utmost importance to the mandate of the public protector.
Just relating to the previous question of the one of the colleagues here, in the annual report you would have seen the legal cost for litigation for the office. Well, sizable amount, 10 million and more, and relating to the judgment that all decisions are binding now, what's your perspective? Do you expect that cost to rise because people would challenge it, or how else can one bring it down?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member, I think considering the judgments that are there, any reasonable person who's in the position of the public protector will introspect. The office will introspect. It has to introspect. See what they have been doing wrong. See, rectify, put in mechanisms to rectify the wrong that has been done, to bring down the fees of the litigation. What shouldn't happen is for the office of the public protector to fear taking decisions because of litigation costs. If the decisions are supported by the rule of law, by the evidence, they are decisions that have been thoroughly assessed, decisions must be taken and the rule of law must prevail.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. Thank you very much, Advocate Baleka. Thank you for something to serve our nation. Thank you very much. One question that I have, what is your impression of this interview process? Do you think it was fair?
Thank you, Chairperson. I must really thank the committee. I think the interview was fair. If a person is to be appointed as a deputy public protector, they need to account. And accountability starts with me on the decisions that I have taken, so that the committee can be confident that indeed I am the person who they can possibly appoint as a public protector. If there was no interrogation, the committee wouldn't know. The people of South Africa must have confidence and know that the person who would be appointed as a public protector is a person who is willing to account and who can be held accountable by this committee. And I think it's exactly what this committee has done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our intention is to conclude this process before we rise. We are rising on the 6th of December. And we are pushing that the House must make a decision before that time. So in a few weeks' time, you will know your fate. And the country will know who is going to be the next deputy public protector. We only have a few weeks. We will communicate our decision.
Thank you, Chair.
No, it's a continuation of this poster, right? You are excused.